Oh, you know, this is embarrassing because I actually watched the Oscar winner Crash.
Oh, no.
And I was surprised that Cronenberg made that. Didn't seem like his style.
It's real bad.
Like, there was a crash, and so I was ready for the sex to start happening, but it never came. It was just racial strife.
Yeah.
Just a lot of crying.
But that's not as embarrassing as in 2006 when they accidentally presented the Oscar to Cronenberg for this movie. Kind of one of the more famous Oscar snafus.
Yeah. Yeah, Cronenberg looked really embarrassed. It was weird he was even there. But great ceremony. Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the film podcast for lovers of difficult or just plain crazy cinema. I'm Mark Dottavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're discussing perhaps the most controversial film by one of our most controversial directors, the chronicler of everything depraved, disgusting, and often mutated about the human body. That director is David Cronenberg, and the film is 1996's adaptation of J.G. Ballard's truly shocking 1973 novel, Crash. Gentlemen, start your engines.
Oh my God, vroom vroom.
Is that a good one?
Mark, you just kill me every time. He's just trying to one-up himself every single time.
I was waiting the entire time to hear whether you were going to say start your engines or buckle up. I knew it was going to be one of the two.
I was going to say get out your beige outfits and your bad hairdos.
Well, see, that's why I do the introductions. That was too long.
You think the hairdos are bad in this movie?
Well, just Spaders.
Not the classic Spader cut.
Holly Hunter does have a bad haircut.
I like her hair.
You do? Wow.
Everything about her, I'm in for it.
On that note, let me introduce our very special guest today. We have Andrew Swafford, one of the founders of Cinematary, whose weekly podcast Seth often appears on. I popped in once to talk about Titanic. It is quite a good podcast. Everybody should check it out, as well as cinematary.com. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, very happy to be here. Very happy to be talking about a movie that I think is compulsively watchable. I am glued to the screen when Crash is on. You know, I guess it is a controversial film.
It is controversial.
It could clear out a room.
Yeah, that's the room I want to be in.
I think this is a good time to be talking about David Cronenberg in particular, because he does have a new film out, Crimes of the Future, which I have not yet seen.
Ooh, I loved Crimes of the Future.
Oh, I see that.
Oh, man. In many ways, it is kind of a remake of Crash specifically. So I think your feelings about this movie will probably determine your feelings on that movie.
Well, that remains to be seen then. We'll see.
I'm seeing the glimmer in Mark's eye already. I can already see what's happening. But Andrew, would you call yourself the director of Cinematary Podcast?
I would not call myself the director. I think the director would have to be Zach, who's on every episode of the podcast and edits the podcast.
That's true.
You could say I'm the producer, but that implies that I edit, which I do not.
Well, he's not here now, so you can take all the credit.
You're like the hot lady on the hood of the car.
I'm the hot lady on the hood of the car. He drives the car. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you flip off of it. I've always appreciated Andrew and his podcast. It was the first podcast I was ever on. I never even listened to podcasts really. And then I just was looking for a place to write about films. And I was basically a place to write about Plague Dogs, because I just had a big old. I just really wanted to type about Plague Dogs all the time because I love that movie a lot.
And that was a very interesting timing, because we do these series on Cinematary where every 4 or 5 weeks we kind of switch gears what we're talking about. And we happened to be doing a series on international animation at that point. And you just emailed me and said, hey, want to write about Plague Dogs? And you wrote a great essay. So I wanted to keep you around and invite you to come on.
And we ended up talking about Plague Dogs on this podcast. So everything came full circle.
That's right.
I'm going to start a plague cast. Just talking about Plague Dogs. That's all.
We love it. Plague Dog Minute.
Well, maybe you'll tackle Crimes of the Future if you haven't already on some future episode once everyone else gets the opportunity to see it.
Mm-hmm. I've talked about it in one of our recent episodes because we do kind of a split structure where the first half of the episode is just people talking about what they've been watching in the last week, like whatever. And then the second half of the podcast is talking about a focused topic like you guys dedicate a whole episode to here. So there's an episode a couple weeks back where I gave a pitch for why people should see Crimes of the Future if people want to go dig deeper into that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then Cronenberg is in the air. And I would like to talk a little bit about his other movies before we dive into Crash, because there's a lot of them that I really, really like. And anyone who doesn't know, he's a Canadian filmmaker, director, writer, who specializes in horror, sci-fi kind of films. But over the years, he's branched out into like psychological dramas, did a gangster film, other kind of weird little, you know, genre pieces or adaptations. And he's still releasing films to as recently as this year. Crimes of the Future opened at Cannes. So, but he goes all the way back to probably his first really feature length legitimate movie was Shivers back in 1975, which really came right out the gate to tell you pretty much everything you need to know about David Cronenberg. He jumps right into the body horror, which is really his thing.
Is that the vagina armpit?
That's Rabid.
Okay.
that came right afterwards. But those two films I did just recently rewatch, and you know, it's really cool to see him as this scrappy young director, and they kind of remind me of like early George Romero films in that they have a lot of, let's say, amateur type actors in them and lower production values, but he quickly started making more commercial films, at least for a brief time. I know even Rabid became one of the highest grossing Canadian films of all time, which kind of helped him cross over into the US.
I did not know that.
Man, Canada's so cool. Wow. They like that. They're freaks. They're freaks.
Yeah. And then he went on to, you know, movies like Scanners actually started to have some success in the States. And then he had kind of a brief dalliance with more like mainstream Hollywood with movies like The Dead Zone, The Fly. And, yeah, I'm interested to hear what you guys, what your general feelings are about David Cronenberg. If you have any favorite films, least favorites, what's your favorite?
I would say that I really love David Cronenberg. And my appreciation of him has sort of only recently kind of become a thing I've realized. Because I've seen a lot of his movies over the years. He's one of those directors that like he has so many movies that you could see eight of them and still not even like be, you know, close to having your arms all the way around it. But when I recently watched Crimes of the Future, that kind of got me on a bit of a Cronenberg kick. And I went and watched Existence, and I went and watched Dangerous Method. And it just kind of got me thinking about how this guy is one of the only filmmakers, maybe the only filmmaker, to kind of like create his own subgenre of horror in the same way that like Lovecraft did in the early 1900s, right? Like new kinds of horror don't come around all that often. So like when you said that term body horror earlier, and like everybody knows what you mean, but like that wouldn't exactly really be like a concept in like horror culture if not for this guy.
Yeah, you could use the word Cronenbergian and most people will know what you're talking about. One of the few filmmakers, you know?
That's right. There aren't that many filmmakers you can do that for. Yeah.
Crony.
Yeah. What about you, Seth?
I would describe myself as a crony for sure. he's like an early example of me finding my leg and footing in horror, I think, because I was like skeptical at first about horror because I was a little pretentious teenager cinephile or something. And when I was also growing up in the worst time, like of like horror movies were like just real trashy and stuff, at least in the mainstream. And I didn't understand what was happening. I was dumb. I was blind. And he's sort of like this blurred line, like it's horror, but it's surreal. It's about science some of the time. And oftentimes it's about sexuality, which is always like really of interest to me as far as like art and sexuality and how they go together. I love that he's an artist who's like extremely unafraid to put his preoccupations or explore.
I know you guys recently did an episode of this podcast about a couple of porn films, and I read y'all's Letterboxd reviews about those, and I forget who it was. I think it was you, Seth, talking about how like you want erotic films to actually be erotic and not like be interrupted with like jokes or some sort of weird contrivance, right?
Right. That was the toss up for me with a lot of them, which was just like I was enjoying it a lot when it was trying to be a movie. And then I would be like, oh, yeah, now it's just a movie.
And I agree. And I think that one thing that's great about Cronenberg is, like you said, he's unafraid to kind of just focus on people's experiences of sexual pleasure. But he also does it in like, I think, a genuinely erotic way. Like, even if you do not find the act or the object you are looking at to be erotic, like the way that he films it and the way that like the score and everything comes together generally like gives that impression anyways, right?
Yeah, you like to see, at least I do, I like to see somebody like sharing something that they're into, even if I'm not into it or something, right? I can at least see like, and even if it's not sexual or something, just like, show me your records. Maybe I don't like them, but I like will enjoy you get pontificating about how like how much you like these or something.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite's probably Naked Lunch.
My favorite is Crash, but second favorite would probably be Videodrome, followed maybe by Crimes of the Future.
I haven't seen Videodrome in a while, but that's like the big old jewel in the crown, I feel like, that people like talk about the most.
It's great. Yeah.
And there's a lot I haven't seen. I think Existence is one of those that just like a lot of people haven't seen. Spider? Is that Spider that's Ralph Fiennes?
That's a real I watched that years ago. I remember not thinking much of it at the time.
My weird uncle loves that one.
I think I have seen all of his movies except the newest one. We're all over the map here, I guess, as far as our preferences. That shows how wide his filmography is and that there's not really a consensus about what the, you know, the best one or even ones are.
No one has even mentioned The Fly, which I think a lot of people would point to as his masterpiece, right?
Yeah, and I think for me, there's The Fly and Dead Ringers and everything else.
Oh, yeah. Dead Ringers is so good. That's definitely in my top for him.
Man, I struggled with Dead Ringers when I watched it. I found it a little dull, but I think I maybe watched it in the wrong setting or the wrong frame of mind.
It's tough.
Yeah, I just rewatched it and blew me away. It might be my favorite. It's really tough between that and The Fly, though, because I don't think that he's ever done movies that quite marry the emotional side into the intellectual and horror side like those movies do. And Dead Ringers in particular has Jeremy Irons doing this dual performance as twins, which is just one of the most astonishing performances, in my opinion, in any movie. Besides it just being seamless, they're just like two distinct great performances, and they look exactly the same. He does nothing physically to distinguish them, and you can always tell who is on screen.
It makes you wish there were two Scars in Lion King.
Yeah, and I think that's a good... Looking at his work with actors is a good way to start getting into Crash, too, because, again, he's had some kind of wonky performances in his early movies, especially in Scanners, which is still one I really enjoy. But he started working with people like James Woods in Videodrome or Christopher Walken or Jeff Goldblum or Jeremy Irons I was just talking about.
Am I the only one who thinks they all kind of look like him? They all kind of got, like, flappy skin.
They all kind of look like what?
Him, like David Cronenberg, if you like look him up, he like looks, he's got, they're like very chinny, they're lanky, and they got weird skin. Like, I feel like I'm amazed that he hasn't really worked with Willem Dafoe yet, but that seems like they're all cousins.
He should work with Willem Dafoe. He works with Viggo Mortensen a lot. History of Violence, Dangerous Method, Crimes of the Future.
He's got weird skin.
Well, now he's moved on to people he wished he looked like. And that's where Viggo Mortensen comes in. But no, I think you have a point there. There's kind of to an extent, there's like a type of lead actor in his movies. Even a Peter Weller in Naked Lunch kind of has a little bit of that, I don't know, James Woods, Jeff Goldblum, kind of the big forehead.
Yeah. I always wonder if it plays into his like fetishizing everything and making it all about like, well, maybe this is somebody's script, but it's actually me like having a weird fantasy in front of you or something.
And I think in addition to some of these actors looking a little like David Cronenberg, now that I'm thinking about it, there's kind of a type of personality that the lead characters tend to inhabit too. Like it's generally like a very stiff kind of guy who over the course of the movie, like has their worldview shaken up or, you know, expands their horizons or something like that. Right.
Definitely. They're very chilly and removed and intellectual at a certain point. And then they either turn into a fly or they got a big vagina opening in their chest.
They surprise yeah. you.
And that's where we go. So for Crash, then, I think no matter what anyone thinks of the movie, that has quite an impressive cast. And this is actually the biggest award he's ever won in his career was for this movie at the Cannes Film Festival, where they gave it the special jury prize, which is not an award they give out every year. It's basically up to the jury to say like, well, this isn't going to win, you know, the big prize or anything, but we want to give some special recognition to this. And so
you got to hand it to
him. Yeah, he went there.
Yeah. Francis Ford Coppola was the head of the jury that year. And he awarded it to Crash for, and this is quote, for originality, for daring, and for audacity. Although he did note that certain jury members abstained very passionately.
I would have loved to overhear that conversation.
Oh, man, yeah.
Tony, can you look up who else was in the Cannes jury that year with Coppola and, I guess, 96?
Oh, yeah, I
want
to know.
Because I would love to speculate on which one of them abstained very passionately.
There's an IndieWire article from 2020 that says, according to Cronenberg, it was a Coppola. You guys will know who these people are, probably.
I don't really recognize any of these names other than Francis Ford Coppola.
Some wet blankets. Oh, Adam Egoyan's in there. Did Exotica, The Sweet Hereafter.
Oh, I've been meaning to watch Exotica. I've never seen it.
I'm going to bring that up during this conversation, too, because Elias Koteas is in that movie, who plays Vaughn in this film, and it almost seems similar. There's no way Adam Egoyan was the one who abstained. No way.
No, definitely. I can't see him doing that.
He was jacking it.
Can I ask a question to somebody who has seen that guy in another movie? Is Cronenberg like making him just look like a corpse in this movie, or is this just kind of how he looks in all of his films?
He is not scarred like he is in this movie.
Yeah.
He's not looking his best in this.
He's just very pale and bony, and like he just looks like he's going to keel over at any moment to me.
Yeah, I would cross the street.
So anyways, it was a very controversial choice that year to recognize that. The movie itself was controversial, and we'll talk about all the reasons that it is. But I do want to address the book real quick, which is by J.G. Ballard, came out in 1973. He's an English author who's probably most well-known, at least cinematically, for Empire of the Sun, which is kind of like an autobiography of him growing up in Japanese-occupied Shanghai, Spielberg movie.
It's so weird. Christian Bale playing J.G. Ballard. I feel like J.G. Ballard has, like, I don't know if he's, like, really... He's lucky to get Christian Bale to play him as a little kid. I bet he was a pudgy little lame-looking kid. And I don't think he looked anything like James Spader in this movie, who is supposed to be J.G. Ballard, right?
So in the book, is the character named James Ballard?
Yes. And
What? So it is him jacking off.
Yep.
That's so cool. I love that.
And that's a really strange thing here, is that the narrator is supposed to be J.G. Ballard. However, he's like a television producer like he is in the movie. So
right. It's
strange where it's like he's using his name and saying it in the first person, but he's not the J.G. Ballard that we know.
It reminds me of Franz Kafka and like all of Kafka's novels having a protagonist named Joseph K. And Le K, I think most people assume, stands for Kafka.
Oh.
Well, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, he was a big old science fiction guy, like very influential in science fiction before he started getting into more like abstract stuff like Crash and Atrocity Exhibition. But before that, it was like Drowned World and High Rise and more of these like groundbreaking science fiction, but nothing like this, like which ventures, they start to venture more into like Burroughs territory or something.
For sure. I had no idea he was such a freak. Like,
non-derogatory.
Yeah, yeah. Because I did read the book in preparation for this, and it is quite a ride. It is more, I mean, for lack of a better word.
I want that to be your blurb on the back of the book, Mark. It's a ride.
Which one is more, quote-unquote, unwatchable between the book and the movie?
I think the book definitely is.
Okay.
Wow. I found the book to be deeply unpleasant. Sometimes.
Is it just because you have to sit so long with the descriptions of this stuff?
Yes. Actually, that's exactly the reason. It's only 200 pages, and yet sometimes the long, long, endless, repetitive descriptions of, you know, semen and anuses and car dials and steering wheels and things is unpleasant in a productive way. And then there's a certain point where it starts to get exhausting. And when I was trying to kind of speed through it to get it done in time to watch the movie and talk about it, that was a rough time. This is really something to read like 30 pages at a time, and maybe should have been a novella or a short story or something.
Wait, question. Did you watch Crash for the first time for this podcast and do all that prep for it?
Not technically, because I did watch it many years ago, but I honestly remembered almost nothing about it. So it really was like watching it for the first time. In fact, when I was reading it, and we have this character of Vaughn, who is this, you know, fetishist who chases car accidents around and kind of recruits them into his little, you know, sexual group. I was picturing James Spader because James, I mean, between like this movie, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Secretary, he was like the pervert laureate of the 90s. And
yeah, what's his deal?
It turns out in the movie, he plays the J.G. Ballard character, who's kind of the one who's inducted into this after he survives a car crash, starts having an affair with the wife of the man that he killed in the car crash accidentally. And then he just gets kind of sucked into this whole world that circles around this Vaughn character, who is obsessed with car crashes, with sexualizing them. And in particular, in the book, about trying to fantasize and orchestrate a car crash with a famous film actress, which is Elizabeth Taylor in the book, and is something that's left completely out of the movie, as far as I can tell, where he is actually trying to target this somebody because he is, is getting this erotic thrill out of it. And
that's cool.
Yeah. So I'm not really reading the book. It was just like, boy, I don't know who saw a movie in this. Apparently it was Cronenberg. I'm not really sure what to make of it. It's very, I don't know. It's compelling page to page, very well written, but the whole point of it and how it all hangs together seems dubious to me.
Do you think that reading it dampened your experience of watching the movie because you were kind of like worn out by this stuff?
It may have, actually. Although it also might have, I mean, it may have made the movie seem less shocking.
Yeah. I put this on with a friend, not really knowing like what it was going to be. Like I had an idea of what it was going to be, but I didn't really know what it was going to be.
Dude, he makes horror movies, bro.
And when they left my house that night, they asked, was that a date that we just had? Like, because, I mean, it's just a very singular experience to have with somebody, just like to watch Crash unfold, not really knowing where it's going.
Was it a date?
It was not a date.
They were wrong.
And then they just slammed the door. And I read like 50 pages of the book, not because I didn't like it.
That's about the right amount.
Mark, you know, I don't know. We're a little different.
Dude, if you want my copy, you can have it, bro.
I want it.
It's yours.
I'm more slutty and gross than you. And I'm also slutty with books, and that's why I didn't finish it, because really I loved it. But I just wind up, I work at a library and I wind up grabbing something else and then I start reading that one and then I grab something else and I start reading that one. But
can't be monogamous.
I was very curious about the impulse of making it a movie, because as much as it's like describing visual things and it's like very like, it's like paragraphs of fetishizing things, it's more like poetic, and like so much of it is mental. So much of it is going on in the characters' heads, like, which is true to like what sexuality, and like a lot of it is what you don't see. A lot of it is what's on the page. And that is kind of what's funny to watch the movie. There's a, like, that's where the staleness comes in and sort of the mystique comes in with the movie, where it is just like, everybody's so like deadpan, dead faced very often, mm-hmm. but
there's like a hypnotic vibe to the whole
thing. And you're often like, how did we go from 0 to 100? Right. Like with like, but I imagine, yeah, like from what I gathered from like the bit I read, was like, this is what's going on in their heads while this is going on. And it does add something to the movie for me. That like you're realizing that there's like, from the get-go, there's all sorts of crazy things like going on behind the like dazed look on these people's eyes.
Yeah, even not having read any of it, I think that there's like so much that's like obviously being unstated in every single scene. Like each character is kind of coming at the experience from a different direction or through a different lens based on the various thought processes that you can kind of tell they're going through.
Yeah, the book is very much about the perception of all of these characters and not very plot driven. And that's a problem with a lot of adaptations. The main problem, in my opinion, is that, you know, when what makes a book great is this interior monologue, is the prose, is the way that it's putting you into a headspace that can't really be translated visually. And you kind of got to bring something else to it in order to make a movie successful. And I mean, I don't think Crash is any exception as far as that goes, that there is a, that element is definitely lost, and it's pretty much the everything as far as the book goes. But we'll talk about exactly what the movie does. And just to close off the book conversation, it is a pretty faithful adaptation to the, you know, the bones of everything that happens pretty much are there, with the exception of this whole film actress element that's taken out. So yeah, let's dive in with Crash. We talked about James Spader, who is this guy who shows up after the character played by the James Spader is the one who gets into the car crash with Holly Hunter, who we also already talked about. And he also has a wife played by Deborah Kara Unger, who is from The Game, I think, is the only thing I really knew her from.
Who just drives me wild. She just drives me crazy.
Man, I was wondering if we were going to break the seal on like referring to actors as attractive, which feels like relevant to this movie. But like,
I can't help it.
I mean, she's almost superhuman.
The first shot of this movie is like this like we're floating. The camera's just floating through this aircraft hangar, and then it just like ever so gently lands on the like impossibly perfect body of Deborah Kara Unger. And like, yep, you're listening to this like very hypnotic Howard Shore like experimental guitar music, and it's very erotic, IMO.
First thing we see is her pressing her nipple against a car.
That's right. Plane,
that's right. Plane.
Her and James Spader have not like activated the kink yet. Like, they haven't really gotten it. They're just doing what's referred to as hot wifing. Are you guys familiar with hot wifing?
Am I?
Sure.
For listeners who do not know what hot wifing is, it is like the practice of a married couple having one party go have sex with someone else and then come back and then like tell the story of that in an erotic way. And that's like the dynamic of James Spader and Deborah Kara Unger's characters at the beginning of the movie. It quickly shifts into a different gear, so to speak.
They're both hot wifing, right?
They're both hot wifing.
Spader also has a lady while he's filming some sort of commercial or something, and they both meet up on a balcony and talk about it together.
Yeah,
and fuck on the balcony. But the whole time they're like looking down, and there's like, if you didn't know anything about the movie, it could already be like a weird thing that like we're lingering so often on the highway, just beyond them, and they seem to be like already gazing on it,
mm-hmm.
which is this thing. Like, I agree that the kink isn't activated yet, probably, but sometimes I find myself like going. I get like halfway through this movie and I go backwards. I'm trying to like, wait, when did this happen? When did this start?
Yeah.
And really, like, it's really hard to diagnose. Like, it's like, as far as, like, is there, I mean, there are instigating factors, but everybody seems kind of like they're already, like, maybe not directly thinking about, like, this specific kink or whatever you want to call it, but they're already, like, dwelling on some, like, wildness.
Right.
Some, like, otherworldly wildness. They're in a weird place that, like, you kind of realize pretty quickly, which I think is kind of interesting about it, that it isn't this, like, James Spader is, like, a normal, everyday guy and all of a sudden happens into a sex cult or something like that. It's not that movie.
I mentioned earlier that Crimes of the Future feels to me like kind of a remake of this movie. And in that movie, the sexual fetish that is kind of awoken among the human population is a fetish for surgery, because it is
because it's a Cronenberg film.
Because it's a Cronenberg film, but also, like, there are reasons why, like, it has to do with the trajectory that we're on, as, like, the way that, like, humans are consuming microplastics, and that could potentially, like, deaden our nervous system and stuff like that. And so people might attempt to, like, seek erotic thrills in, like, more and more extreme ways, right? Like, in our world, like, biting is a thing. So, like, extrapolate, you know, some sci-fi concept 100 years out, and, like, you know, what is the most extreme version of that?
Right.
But the reason I brought it up is that, like, in that movie, there's kind of this slow, subtle unfolding of, like, characters realizing they're into it, right? Like, they're into it before they know they're into it. Right, and eventually they have to, like, be honest with themselves that they are.
Yeah, I see what Seth is saying, because, I mean, the characters start out already very, like, chilly and remote. And I feel like they kind of get only go further that way the movie goes. And that's, I mean, when we open with them, they pretty much are already in a healthy, either open or polyamorous relationship. I mean, like, they're using these sexual experiences with other people as a way to enhance their own sex life.
Right. And every time you see James Spader have sex with somebody who's not Deborah Unger, I think it hard cuts to him then having sex with Deborah Unger at home. Like, it is drawing a line. Like, we're not showing you the scene where he tells her about it, but he told her about it, and that's why they're having sex right now.
Right. So, like, they already have their games that they're playing.
I love following that thread, because it is all one. Yeah, it's like one act, like, for him.
Yes.
I love that Cronenberg starts us so far from a regular safe place for a straight audience, right?
Yeah.
Like, most movies would just start with the hot wifing or the, like, sexual experimentation, and that would be the whole movie, right?
Or they'd get to that point.
Or they would have to work up to that, right? They would have to get to that point, right? Which this is just, like, already, like, shutting out, like, a lot of the audience, and a lot of the audience is, like, reaching for, like, something that is to hold on to. And there's no, like, quote unquote normal center, like, from the get-go, and it just keeps going. And it's exciting for that reason. It's everything your grandpa was worried about.
It is. And there, I mean, my basic read in this movie is that it's a very queer movie. Like, it is about people stumbling into not just queerness, but, like, a queer community, and, like, becoming mm-hmm. connected with a network of people and having, like, to, like, completely reorient their lives around this thing that is, like, important to them. But then also this movie comes out right at the tail end of the AIDS crisis. And so the idea that, like, this community could be like in constant danger, or this could be a quote unquote dangerous lifestyle, and that'd be, like, a thing that people were just kind of stuck with, feels like it has this, adds this core of sadness to the movie too. Like, it feels like it's simultaneously, like, kind of celebratory of, like, the sexual diversity on display here, but also, like, mourning it, like, prematurely.
I love that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and that's part of what I struggle with here as far as what the arc is to this movie, because the characters seem like they don't particularly need awakened to anything when they start out. And, you know, they already are, in a way, not actually queer, but it's a, you know, pretty kind of liberal relationship thing, what they're already doing, that you might associate with a queer lifestyle.
Oh, they have same sex, you know. Don't they both like he fucks Vaughn and
well, that's getting ahead of ourselves.
Well, that's what I was going to say is that like I think that is the answer to your question mark about what's the arc of the movie. A big arc of the movie is James Spader coming to terms with his own sexuality. Like there are scenes in the middle where Deborah Kerr Unger is fucking him and like dirty talking him about like, don't you want to be with a man? And she's like telling him to respond to him like he doesn't want to say it out loud, but he's kind of getting closer and closer to climax the more she says about it. He's like not being honest with himself about what he really wants until later he actually does like actually do it with Vaughn.
Well, and on the other hand, the thing that they're getting into is centered around violence and even taking other people against their will involved in these car accidents. So that's another kind of strange, you know, metaphor. If you want to look at this as like an AIDS thing, you know, this is something that is darker than that as far as what they're actually pursuing.
Well, I mean, like people have unsafe sex, right? That you could do it. You could probably do the car thing very safely as Vaughn does with the actors and the audience and stuff like that. Or you could be a little reckless, which, you know, people are when it comes to their like horny brain. And of course, like we also didn't have a lot of protection about things like that or like spread of HIV specifically in the mid 90s. Right.
Right. So is this a cautionary tale or?
I don't know if I would say it's a cautionary tale.
I think it's it's like a cartoonish exaggeration to like celebrate that oftentimes these alternative sexual acts, sexual communities are deemed by the outside. Like they at first, like you're growing up, at least I, like when I was like a little good Christian boy growing up, like S&M, gay relationships, all of this stuff that's like quote unquote taboo, you know, is like literally dangerous and like as dangerous as something like this, like as like people liking car crashes, that's as ludicrous as like someone liking being whipped could be, or someone liking watching their partner being fucked could be, right? But then you start to, you know, if you start to get into such things, you start to realize like it really opens, like it really blows your mind.
Yeah, so much of that stuff is constructed.
Flips everything on its head. Because everything you thought was one way, it's the other way. And you wonder, like, maybe other things, like, are not what I thought. And all of this, it's very exciting for that reason. And the, like, especially sexual awakening in general, which I think a lot of the movie is just about that kind of.
I guess the tone that I get from this movie, even before we get to the end point, is more fatalistic than celebratory.
That's interesting. Yeah, for sure.
Celebratory is probably too strong of a word. I think that like maybe humanizing would be a term, right? Though, I mean, that's kind of a weird thing because like, you know, queer people don't need to be humanized. They're already human. But
I'm going to stick with celebratory. It's a party.
Don't invite me to this party.
I feel like he has some sort of a kinship to these people, right?
Well, I just wanted to lay a little more groundwork here just for anybody listening who doesn't know that the Holly Hunter and him start hooking up after he essentially kills her husband in a car accident by accident. Holly Hunter of Raising Arizona, The Piano, great actress.
Yeah, it's filmed like a sexy scene, the car crash. It's like it's very stylized and intense.
Well, her boob pops out.
Yeah, her boob pops out. It's like a...
I would argue that like almost every scene in this movie is a sex scene.
Yeah.
Like, but not everybody involved knows it's a sex scene, right?
Honestly, almost literally every scene is a sex scene, but...
Yeah, the term the male gaze gets thrown around a lot in, you know, film criticism. And like in many cases, like in ways that it was not originally intended to be used. But like the idea that like a camera can linger on a particular body part or a particular sensation and fetishize that is something that Cronenberg uses to fetishize like whatever he wants, right? Even if it is not like explicitly sexual on the surface.
Well, yeah, and let's talk about Elias Codius, who is the central figure of as far as being obsessed with all of this stuff. And like I said, he is in Exotica, and he spends most of that movie like doing these monologues like to an audience at a strip club. And I couldn't help but think of that when he's basically doing like another monologue just like that, when they're reenacting this James Dean crash, which is a scene that that I like. It's a very good introduction to him, that he has this stuntman crony basically who helps him reenact these car crashes illicitly.
Well, before that, you see him as a like posing as a doctor in the hospital where James Spader is staying.
He actually is a doctor. That's clearer in the book.
Oh, really?
He is?
In the book, he was like a TV doctor who got into this big car accident that kind of derailed his career and turned him into this freak. And I was kind of surprised we don't get any of that backstory, unless I missed it in here, as far as like what got him into this. What was his big thing? How did he meet all these other people besides, I mean, we do get a little thing like, okay, here's the accident I met this girl in. But it doesn't really go into that.
It's like Seth was saying, we don't really get anybody's backstory, right?
We
just pick up on all these people's lives like for this snapshot of time, and like, they have lives that obviously span past this too, but like we're just getting that glimpse.
And he has a great batting average of finding people who get into car crashes and then suddenly their entire life revolves around how erotic they find them. Like he's got this whole group of people, this guy and his wife are both turned on by it and the girl that he hit. And, you know, they hang around and they watch crash test videos and touch themselves and touch each other during them.
It's set in a parallel universe where that is a thing that, like, lots of people are, like, secretly into, right? Like, there can be an event where, like, people can fill up bleachers for this, which is also a thing in Crimes of the Future. One of the main character, Viggo Mortensen, is, like, a performance artist, and he, like, gets surgery on stage, and he just, like, fills up these stadiums of people who come basically to get off watching him do that.
See, that's what I was wondering, because there is like it's real subtle with how it addresses that, but it's just like how far reaching this what would be viewed as a problem is, right? Because there's the scene where Elias, the Vaughn character, reenacts the car crash of James Dean, and they really do it, and it's like crazy and everybody's watching it and stuff. And the cops show up and stop them, and they all like run like it's a drug bust or something.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know. It seems more to me like a Fight Club or something. There is something dark and perverted about it in like an objective way. This is something, you know. Our main figure here, Vaughn, is a disturbed person. He is antisocial. He tries to kill people at different points. He tries to hit James Spader and then later him and his wife. That there's a story here of obsession and of unhealthiness going on in here, which is I guess where some of the muddling comes for me as far as the art going, that every reading that I try to put onto it then is complicated by something else that makes that particular reading not quite come together for me. That this is supposed to be like a descent where they're getting too far in over their heads, which is not a queer story. And I also don't think that it particularly commits to that sense of the characters being drawn in or things getting out of control. And maybe what I was looking for was what really does appeal about this to them. And I guess lacking that stuff from the book, or the way that everything's just left in the air like a mystery, like these people are just into it, I'm not sure that Cronenberg really gives me that in the filmmaking, as far as showing me what is so seductive about this skeevy pervert who seems like a fucking weirdo and not somebody who is, he's like the opposite of seductive. He's creepy and weird.
Right. He's a corpse.
Yeah.
He's a corpse.
He looks like a corpse. Yeah.
And I almost seems like he's just kind of reveling in the grotesqueness of it for its own sake.
But I feel like that's kind of the same thing with like someone who would be straight being like, well, that's the whole thing. Like, guys are ugly, right? Or like, they're hairy.
Right, but they're wrong. I think they're right to think that in this movie.
I don't know. I mean, I could definitely stretch my imagination to understand like why a car accident would be like exciting. Or like, even like, or why, like, I could dream up a person, because there's been plenty of people who have like gotten off to like very morbid things, like even more morbid than this, like fucking Jeffrey Dahmer or something. But like,
wait, instead of jumping to Jeffrey Dahmer, can we look at some like more real world examples of like people enjoy fucking in cars, people sure. enjoy getting roadhead, you know, like this is just kind of one click further than that, right? Where like you're doing near misses and like driving recklessly and like getting your adrenaline to that like panic state.
Or stalking people who are in car accidents and photographing them secretly and stalking them.
Okay, so about the Vaughn thing. I think that he is like, you know, unequivocally like the most, I don't know, fearsome person in this movie. I don't necessarily want to call him a villain per se, but I think he's kind of like the cause of some of the tragedy in this movie. And I like to think of this more as a tragedy than as, I think, what you're framing it as, which is a cautionary tale. I don't think that Cronenberg showing us a queer subculture plagued by death is a thing that he's doing in order to warn people not to be queer. I think he's like trying to give us an actual empathetic like portrait of that experience, like, but doing it through this kind of sci-fi conceit that lets us keep it at arm's length.
Well, yeah, and I don't think that he's doing it in a way that is queer negative. That's just why I think that the queer reading doesn't entirely hold up with the movie. Is what I'm saying. Not that he's doing it in a derogatory way, but that he's doing some counterproductive things if that is what we're supposed to be taking away from it.
What do you think is counterproductive, though?
The way that it's so much about the darkness and the depravity of it, and that's like the point of what they're into, and that this character who is introducing them to this world is disturbed and unhealthy.
I mean, in a story that was literally about AIDS, if it had a antagonist or a, you know, some sort of malevolent force in the movie, wouldn't it make sense for maybe that character to be someone who kind of recklessly has sex despite knowing they have AIDS or something like that, right? Like, I think that Vaughn's character is sort of that like unsafe sex haver, basically.
Right. But then that's a whole other thing. Then it's like, okay, why are we watching the movie about unsafe sex haver purposefully spreading AIDS? Because that's what gets him off. That's not really a great queer story.
Well, we are following the story. I mean, I don't think it has to be a happy story to be a queer story, right? I think we are following the story of a straight couple becoming involved in a subculture and then like there being kind of this threat in that subculture that they then have to navigate.
Yeah, I think maybe blowing it up to subculture, like we you know, there's queer readings that are maybe start and stop, which is that's always my thing with like readings of, I don't know, reading into things in general. Like I pretty much always realize that like, sometimes it's me seeing it, sometimes it's them seeing it, and sometimes it was them seeing it for part of like what they were working on, and then it stops and becomes something else, which I could see certain things working that way. But it's definitely, yeah, what happens when you join an alternative subculture.
And I think that, well, yeah, I mean, we're really getting into the mud here. If it hasn't become clear, I'm not a big fan of this movie.
No.
And I think part of the problem just cinematically is that I think it is important that it somehow communicates what is appealing about this. And again, the book is just pages and pages and pages of prose and poetry and lyricism about exactly like these fantasies and everything. And without that, a lot of this movie to me is just a lot of shots of people looking at cars, having sex in cars, driving, crashing cars. It doesn't translate any of that.
So it doesn't compute for me. Like, I don't feel like I want an explanation of why they find it sexy, right? I just want the filmmaker to attempt to make me feel like it's sexy, like put me in that headspace, whether I understand it or not. Right. And I think that the way these scenes are filmed is very erotic. Like the camera will just like there's a scene when James Spader gets in the car with Holly Hunter for the first time and he's like caressing his seatbelt. And like the camera is like right over his shoulder, close up on that seatbelt. And like that is an erotic scene that where no sex is actually happening, right? But it's like making that association in our head between, you know, the car and the sexual experience.
Now, I totally agree with you on that instance because that did stick out to me. It stuck out to me because it was like one of the only times I felt that.
I want to agree with both of you in turn. So like,
you got to choose sides, Seth.
No,
this is a battle to the death.
All right. I agree with Andrew that I don't need explanations in that, like, I don't think any of us really need, real explanations for why we like what we like. Like,
agreed. Yeah.
Write book after book about like why we might like something, but it won't like really explain it to someone who doesn't get into whatever it is that I'm into. I definitely agree with Mark's point, and it is like a low point for me. I could get why you would chafe on this movie because it is so, it's kind of like real straight laced sometimes as far as like the cinematography and filmmaking itself. It's very clinical, and it does, like, you would think they would be shooting this in a very lyrical, like poetic way, like maybe like weird lights and stuff even, because they're like sexualizing everything in such a way. But it does get to a certain point where it is just like, and this is both where like I feel like I understand why you would leave the room, but also why it's like at least interesting in theory to me very much, that it's like this movie that is, it starts to really feel like a movie that is for people who like getting in car wrecks.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Is that what we've learned about Andrew?
That is not what we're learning about Andrew today. I mean, as somebody who really likes slow cinema, I think that the way the camera will just like hold shots for a really long time and like kind of slowly glide into a set, like it does in the first shot, like it does in the scene where Deborah Kerr Unger and James Spader are fucking and she's like trying to get him to talk about having sex with men. Like that is just almost just one shot of like them having like a full session of sex. Like I think like the patience of this movie in terms of like clinical is definitely an accurate way to describe it. But I think like the more positive spin is it's kind of like patient and brooding or something. And that works for me anyways.
Yeah, and that's probably, I mean, that's like a, I guess, a personal preference, because he does in general have kind of a purposefully kind of sterile, distanced style. And I think maybe that, for me, that wasn't a good match for this material in particular.
I think that what makes it feel not like sterile and stale to me is probably Howard Shore's music. That guitar score is incredible.
It's very moody.
I don't even really know how he made those sounds. And like that just kind of makes the whole movie into this vibe.
Yeah, it's like a guitar orchestra that he'd use. It's a in the same way that like Glenn Branca, which like was an influence on like Sonic Youth, is like a New York, like he like made these guitar ensembles of like dozens and dozens of guitars, and like rather than like a regular orchestra. And Howard Shore is doing this with this in a really interesting way. They're all like hitting like different notes, sometimes harmonizing on the same note, but it's just like ringing out with all this sustain.
And like the,
that's definitely like
the guitars are all like playing very high pitched notes, and they're very tinny sounding. Like the guitars sound like broken glass or something, but it still has this like swoony harmony to it. Actually, I noticed this time that I think the only scene of the movie where the music gets truly sad, like kind of unequivocally sad, is when James Spader approaches Deborah Kerr Unger like on that hillside after her car crash. where he's not sure whether or not she's dead in that moment. Like, then there's like an actual orchestra playing a very sad note. But the rest of it is this weird, ambiguous vibe that I just coast on through the whole movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted at some point here, I was trying to find some sort of passage from the book that I could read. And I'll try to keep it brief here, just to kind of, I don't know, contrast what we're seeing on screen. Maybe just give an idea for anybody who's curious about like the way that this whole like thing is written, like the whole idea behind it. There's a scene in the movie where there's this character played by Roseanne Arquette who is in like leg braces and is particularly kind of disabled from her car accident. And she's into all of this stuff too. And at some point, I mean, pretty much everyone kind of ends up having sex with everyone in this movie. And and at one point she does end up with James Spader. So this character, Gabrielle, you know, this happens in the book where he is, you know, the two of them are finally getting together. And it's a good example of how all the sex scenes and stuff are written in it. And it jumps around a little bit. And Tony, feel free to just go ahead and, you know, edit this if this is too long, but I'll try to make it go quickly. So, as I unshackled the left leg brace and ran my fingers along the deep buckle groove, the corrugated skin felt hot and tender, more exciting than the membrane of a vagina. This depraved orifice, the invagination of a sexual organ still in the embryonic stages of its evolution, reminded me of the small wounds on my own body, which still carried the contours of the instrument panel and controls. These were the templates for new genital organs, the molds of sexual possibilities yet to be created in 100 experimental car crashes. I explored the scars on her thighs and arms, feeling for the wound areas under her left breast as she in turn explored mine, deciphering together these codes of sexuality made possible by our two car crashes. I dreamed of other accidents that might enlarge this repertory of orifices, relating them to more elements of the automobile's engineering, to the ever more complex technologies of the future. As I embraced Gabrielle, I visualized, as Vaughn had taught me, the wounds upon which erotic fantasies might be erected, the extraordinary sexual acts celebrating the possibilities of unimagined technologies.
Man, that's some, I don't think I would like to read 200 pages of that, but that is some prose.
Yes.
It is so awesome.
And then in the movie, he's just fucking her in a car. And like, I got nothing out of it. He's just fucking her in a car. And I don't know, that's just in a nutshell kind of. And maybe that's because I was coming hot off the book, but
he's still licking her scar and stuff.
But then it's just gross. It's not like,
yeah,
I don't know, interesting. Too much of it ended up being tedious for me when I feel like that is not what he meant.
Mm.
But that's subjective.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just kind of a your mileage may vary
thing. Yeah,
I guess I see it as it's at least it's interesting. I don't know if it really sustains me as much as a viewer as if it would have been more stylized. But it's interesting that it's a very different take than the book, right? So that they aren't totally trying to show you the mental life. They leave that to the book. So now we just, what are we left with? We're left with this sort of, yeah, like what it actually looks like, right? There's the crazy William S. Burroughs type sex that they're having in their heads. And then there's the actual act of what it looks like, which is often really like kind of awkward.
Oh, sex is hilarious. You ever just watch two people have sex? It's silly.
Yeah, a lot of it's like really kind of awkward some of the time.
Right.
Some of the times it's not. It depends on your like outlook and like, I don't know, maybe at the beginning of the movie I wasn't feeling it. And then after a while I was getting a little hot and bothered by certain scenes. Maybe not this scene, but this scene. So therefore, as I went along, yeah, I don't know. It like depends. I was getting seduced. I get seduced by the movie after a while.
Right. I think that's what this movie and Crimes of the Future are kind of trying to do, to like suck the viewer into its orbit. Like, see if it can make you one of these people too.
Oh no.
But I do think I would love to see more style to this, I guess. A little something, but again, it's interesting as is in a in a stranger way, actually.
I think it tries a little bit in that car wash scene where he's driving him through a car wash and he's having sex with his wife in the back. And, you know, there's a few shots where he kind of amps up the, like, noises on the soundtrack of, like, the things, like, dragging across the windshield, shots of the water. Again, in the book, it makes a little more of a, there we go, flappers. Yeah, and, you know, in the book, it's a little more of a parallel between, like, you know, the imagery of the white suds on the car and, you know, and the sex going on inside. And I could see him trying to do some of that in that scene. So maybe that's, you know, a good example of that.
I love the first time him and Holly Hunter have sex. It is, like, the most fumbling, like, little sex scene in a car. As awkward as sex in a car can be.
There's so much logistics around, like, the steering wheel being in the way and stuff like that.
And just like, oh, there's, like, all these problems we have to work through.
But I imagine that's part of the appeal for them, you know, kind of like people who like being tied up or something. Like, not having full control is part of what's enjoyable at having sex in that location.
Again, everything your grandpa warned you about.
Well, your grandpa warned you of some sick shit.
Yep. These gays are going to start fucking cars next.
What's next? A man in a car?
And that's literally the movie. I love that about this movie. It's just like, yes, it is, Dad. And we're in love.
Have you guys seen Titan? Or Titan is maybe how you say it?
No.
No, but people always compare these two movies.
I heard people talking about whatever that movie is called, and comparing it to Crash when it came out. And I saw it and did not think it was anything like Crash.
Don't they actually fuck cars in that movie?
There is a scene where a woman actually fucks a car. It's like kind of a it's a conceit. It is a suspension of disbelief thing. Like, you have to believe that she can be impregnated by a car, and it, like, never gives you any sort of exclamation for that. But I didn't like that movie at all. And, like, the thing that you guys are complaining about Crash as, like, not being erotically filmed or stylistically filmed enough, like, Titan is just super gross, like, super unpleasant, super abrasive all the time. So, I mean, I think that Cronenberg is at least attempting to kind of, like, sway things in the more seductive direction, right? Whether or not he always lands for each individual viewer, I guess, is subject to their perspective, right?
I could go with that. I mean, if I could see it that they are what I'm calling stale, they're just kind of filmed maybe like soap opera sex scenes, right? They're like, or something. The soap opera.
I don't know what soap opera you're watching, Seth.
Yeah, the soap opera version of people who like car crashes.
Seth has never seen a soap opera.
It's kind of great in that way. I love that.
Actually, I remember when Crimes of the Future opened at Cannes, I remember reading in the news, and I just pulled up the quote here because Viggo Mortensen was talking to like a reporter or something, and he said, quote, "In my opinion, no offense to the director of Titan, but Crash was head and shoulders above that movie because it wasn't just about superficial shock value and unconventional imagery. There was a story beneath it, much more than Titan."
He's right, and he should say it. Yeah.
People were like, oh, look at him beating up on Titan.
Poor Titan.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Titan is kind of a shock value movie, to be honest. But I see what people are talking about when they try to interpret it. It doesn't feel like it quite comes together for me. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess say what you want about this one. I don't think that it is about shock value.
No.
I just always go back to it. Is convincingly a sexy movie about car crashes and for, like, debatably four hypothetical people out there who might be interested in this.
Did anybody even really think there was anything that, like, disturbing or extreme in this movie? Because it didn't strike me that way.
Not as far as what we see.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Cronenberg stuff can be pretty firmly put in the horror category. But this does not feel horror to me. Like, I think the conceit, if you explain to people what the movie is about, they will recoil and, you know, freak out a little bit. But there's not, like, scare scenes in this movie, right? Because we're not supposed to find this scary, I don't think. I think we're, like, as the viewer, like, the experience you're placed in is you're torn between, like, your instinctual revulsion to some of the images you're seeing, and the way the film craft is trying to encourage you to reframe and thinking about it in a different way.
I'd call it a spooky steamer.
Yeah, I can't imagine, I don't know, anyone who, like, you know, stormed out of this movie or anything, just if you think, mm-hmm. like, dude, what kind of movies are you watching? Like, this isn't, it's sexual, it's definitely explicit sexually, but that seemed to be the most boundary-pushing thing in it to me. It was the shot of her, like, lifting her hand up and there's semen on it.
That was cool.
I doubt there were many movies at the Cannes Film Festival in 1996 that had as much sex as Crash, or even like to that point.
I think it's just the squeamish feeling that probably audiences, especially like just very straight audiences going into this movie, that again starts at poly, like sexually experimental, and then goes from there. And again, just feeling, I think people are really, I don't know, they're really suspicious of sexiness in movies, especially if it's at the heart of it. They think it's like, well, this must be just frivolous, right?
Or exploitative.
If there's eroticism in like a movie, it's like immediately like, well, then this is just for fun or something. And like, even if it is, like, what's your problem with it, I guess, is mm-hmm. like the thing that I always ask.
I think that's gotten even worse in recent years. Like,
I agree.
Any movie you go to see in the theater now, like a wide release, you're not going to see a sex scene at all, most likely, in it, let alone the kind of explicit stuff you saw in like the 80s and 90s in these movies, like Body Heat or something. Like, there's just, people just section that all off now. And if they like kiss in a superhero movie, people think it's provocative.
Well, Crash was also the era of the erotic thriller.
Yes.
So you could kind of slot it in there.
Yeah. It's like all sorts of sexual experimentation are like encouraged and celebrated, but like, don't actually talk about it and don't actually show it to me. Like, that's like the era we're in right now. And it's really lame.
Yeah. Well, I do want to give a shout out just to the whole cast of this movie, because I do think it's very well cast and the actors put everything that they can into it. And I mean, with people like James Spader, who is just amazing in pretty much anything that he does. And I think Elias Koteas is great, and Holly Hunter.
I think Patricia Arquette is such an underrated actor, period. She doesn't get a ton to do here, but the things that she, like the scenes that she has are really good. Like the scene where she seduces the like car salesman guy is really good.
I forgot that was her. What?
Yeah, or Rosanna Arquette.
Rosanna Arquette, not Patricia Arquette. Sorry. Are they related, right?
Yes. There's all kinds of Arquettes out there.
My brain was freaking out.
But she completely sells Scorsese's After Hours. And she's great in what's the movie with Madonna? Desperately Seeking Susan.
Oh, okay.
So that is one name that I wanted to make sure got a shout out before we passed over it.
This is one of the most 90s casts you could ever have. Like, if Rosanna Arquette and Elias Koteas and Holly Hunter are in your movie, it was made in the 90s.
Because there's Jim Carrey in it.
Now, see, that's a movie that sounds interesting to me.
You want Jim Carrey to be in Crash?
Jim Carrey fucking cars?
I want Jim Carrey in Crash. Yeah, as Vaughn.
I don't. I do not want that. That would become like the cable guy.
I kind of feel like they're in the same universe, along with Seinfeld.
I could see it.
I will say, at the heart of this, my first exposure to this movie, I was super into watching movies. Sometimes people watch porn for fun on their own. I don't know if you've heard of this.
It's been known to happen.
But yeah. I do this, and I've done this. And for a while, I was really into just like purely movie scenes. I just wanted them to be well shot and just to be like that thrill that I never got as a kid, because like anytime anything like close to a sex scene, like we're shutting the movie off, right? So then I would watch them all now on Pornhub or whatever. And the first time I saw any part of this was the scene where James Spader and Unger are fucking in the bed and she's talking about like, and I'm just like, I don't even think I had like the audio up very much.
Oh gosh.
But it's like real hot. And I like wound up watching the clip a lot, like multiple times.
It's a great scene.
And then I think I finally watched it with audio and realized like what crazy shit she was saying. Like she's like talking about like how semen is salty and how she wants him to sodomize, you know.
Could you imagine what his anus looks like?
They do speak clinically.
Yeah.
Like they say penis and anus and sodomize.
Oh man. It was an awakening moment. Perhaps in my bisexuality too. Just, you know, hot lady telling me, you probably like some of that stuff too. And I was like, I suppose so, Miss Unger.
I almost forgot to even mention that Vaughn and Ballard have a sex scene in this.
They do. Oh, we talked about it. We talked about it.
I said he was gay.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, yeah. But like to really go into it, I mean, and I read this in the book, you know, he, again, like everything else graphically, you know, anally penetrates him. And I'm like, all right, if this movie is really that transgressive, they better have this scene in there. And okay. I mean, they do. It's the least graphic of any of the sex scenes in it. Like, you know, they cut away at the right moment, but they do go there.
That was probably a MPAA thing, if I had to guess. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's you can go so far.
Yeah, I don't think Cronenberg is.
They're kind of a, there's a double standard, right, for what is kind of allowed in Hollywood.
Yeah, you're
even
right.
Today, I don't think you see gay sex between men.
Oh, man, no way. It's such... But I think I watched the Internet Archive version of this movie, and it may have cut that out.
Oh, interesting.
Uh-oh.
Because I think they just... The one I saw, it was just like he was getting ready to get fucked in the ass, and then they like cut away to them being done.
I mean, they basically just show his face as if like it seems like it's happening or not. Yeah, like it's happening. And then it does cut away right after that.
Also, Seth, you're watching the Internet Archive version of Crash. There's a beautiful Blu-ray from Criterion that you should watch. So sleek.
I watched this in Ultra HD today.
I just was paying for cheap internet, okay? You know how it is.
Go to your local library, Seth.
I don't know where it is. Maybe they'll employ me.
All right, well, any final thoughts about Crash? And we do like to ask at the end of each podcast if you would unwatch this movie. And usually the answer is pretty clear by the time we get there, but... But if there's anything else you want to throw in, too, as we wrap up the discussion.
I would only unwatch this movie to then rewatch this movie again for the first time.
I would second that. I think it's maybe best the first time. I like it a lot. It's not super high on my Cronin list because it is just like, it's just so is what it is. And I don't know. I don't always have a window in or something. For some of it, I get like lost in the sauce and then I come back and I'm like full on all about it. And not like I'm like, yeah, I don't know. That's how I feel about it.
I'm just going to put in Dead Ringers again when we're done here.
Yeah.
And dive back in there.
That's your little porno.
I might unread the book.
Yeah, I think unread the book.
That does sound exhausting.
Because it's going to take me a while. It's going to take me a while to just get out of that headspace. And I'm so glad I don't have to read it anymore.
Yeah, you also kind of made it, you made it a task for yourself, right? You were trying to squeeze in a whole novel and this challenging movie before like having to present on it. So I feel like that puts a certain amount of pressure on an already very intense experience. Might be worth coming back to at some point.
Yeah, sure.
No. I think I know Mark. I don't know that Mark would like this movie. I just wouldn't think it's a movie for Mark. But I don't know. I could be wrong, Mark.
Well, we'll see. Again, you can have my copy of the book and we'll see. Maybe that changes your perspective.
I don't know. I'm a freak.
Tony just popped out of the ether. Tony, were you going to throw your weight behind or in front of Crash?
Everyone knows I have to remain neutral on the actual movies. I just wanted to point out that I think as of this episode, more of our guests have chosen the unwatch option simply so they could watch the movie again for the first time than guests that have just truly wanted to unwatch something we've made them watch. So we gotta clarify the rules and regulations the next time we do this. the unwatch is permanent. There's no going back.
Yeah. Sorry for being cliche.
No, clearly we're just picking movies people are enthusiastic about and would just like to see again with fresh eyes. But
you got to make the choices more dangerous.
I guess so.
This movie's too watchable.
Two watchables.
Yeah, it is. I think most people could handle this movie, whether you like it or not. I don't see what there is to be afraid of. Unless you find yourself, you know, having sex in the car wash.
I think if you got some real, like, sexual, like, purity culture, sexual repression shit, this would be a tough sit.
That's a good point. Well, maybe more people encounter it on Pornhub in clips. And that's an easier way to approach it.
Yeah, I will email it to you, to your Hotmail, the clip.
Send it to my secret account.
I'm sure it's like just labeled. It doesn't say anything about David Cronenberg. I'm sure it's just labeled like blonde hot chick totally gets boned.
Yeah, just search for that on Pornhub. I'm sure you'll find
it. You'll find
it. I'm sure there's not many other videos like that.
All right. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us and bringing your perspective to this film. And I definitely want to encourage everybody to check out Cinematary, the website and the podcast. Is there anything in particular you wanted to throw out there, let people know about?
I'll just give people an idea basically of what the show is like. I mentioned at the top that it's kind of a dual structured show where we just kind of talk about new releases and things we're watching. But then we also have some sort of a like an academic focus we're placing over the course of 4 or 5 weeks. We do these series, and every summer we do a series called Young Critics Watch Old Movies, where we study the film canon through the decades. So we start with an English language movie from the 20s, then we do a foreign language movie from the 20s, and then we alternate back and forth for every decade from like the 20s to the 80s, I think. And then when we're not doing that, we're jumping back and forth between like different director series or genre series, or sometimes just like thematically connected things. But it's a fun time. People should check it out. If they like this podcast, they will probably like Cinematary as well. And Seth is on it quite a bit, which we're grateful for.
Yeah. I pop in, talk about movies that have not come out recently. Everybody else is up on their recent films, and I talk about some random thing from 1993. It's fun. I love being on Cinematary. It's my favorite.
We love having you.
I love having you here, Andrew. Oh, it was so good to have you here.
this was wonderful. And I think, probably before we get to this point, Tony will have found a good editing point to stop.
Yeah, we'll be good there. And then
I got this feeling on the summer day when you were gone. I crashed my car into the bridge. I watched, I let it burn. I threw your shit into a bag.
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.
Down on earth, but I am up in space. You're so damn hard to please. We gotta kill this switch. You're from the 70s, but I